The title, as you see, is The Prophet's Telescope, Emmanuel. Galileo, with his telescope that he invented, was able to see things in the starry sky that others simply did not see. And he was looking at stars and looking at the moon and looking at planets. And he spent quite a bit of time looking at Jupiter. As he did so, he first discovered three of the 95 moons that Jupiter has. He looked again. There was a fourth one. He looked again, and one of them disappeared. And so he was pondering, what does this mean? How did this happen? And he concluded that the sun has planets revolving around it and so forth. It came to the conclusion that the Earth was not the center of the universe. As you're probably aware, that put him in conflict with church officials whose interpretation of Genesis was that, well, since Earth had the center, the most important feature of God's creation, that is humanity, then they argued that man and Earth must be at the center of the universe. And as a result, Galileo was tried and convicted for heresy. But the point that I'm raising is he was able to see with his telescope things that others had not seen. He looked at it, tried to figure out what was going on, and came to the conclusion that the traditional model just didn't explain the details, just couldn't account for why moons around Jupiter would appear and then disappear. There were other things that he noticed, other features, but this was the starting point of him coming to the conclusion that the universe did not revolve around planet Earth. As we look at the book of Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah also has a telescope. His telescope is God's revelation. God reveals truth to him that he would not be capable of seeing on his own. He then records that, as did other writers of Scripture, as God revealed truth to them. There are features of what he saw, or what was revealed to him, that are rather controversial. Isaiah 7:14 is one of those passages that has become quite controversial. If you are in Isaiah, take a look at verse 14. Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Now, Emmanuel means God with us. In recent times, it has become fashionable to say that Isaiah was not predicting something that would happen in 4 BC, that he was not predicting the birth of Jesus. But instead, he was talking about there was a young woman who at this point was unmarried, who very shortly would become married and would have a son. Nothing particularly spectacular there. That happens all the time. But that has become the fashionable interpretation in biblical scholarship. We are going to analyze this passage to find out what is it exactly that Isaiah is talking about, and will give evidence for what he is arguing. We're going to set up the historical background for this passage so that we know where to fit this in into history. The timing on this is the 8th century BC. In Isaiah 7:1, Rezin, that was the name of the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, Israel being the northern kingdom. This is after the split. Remember, after the death of Solomon, the nation of Israel split into two parts. The northern part rebelled and took the name Israel. The southern portion remained true, and they adopted the name Judah. Well, Israel has joined into an alliance with Syria, also known as Aram, and that's creating a difficulty because Syria and Israel are getting ready to attack Judah. Well, let's read a little bit more here in the passage. Starting at 7:1, now it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, Ahaz king, he's son of Jotham. Jotham was the king before him, son of Uzziah, that's Ahaz's grandfather who is king before him, so king of Judah, that Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to make war against it, but could not prevail against it. Now at this point, they have not yet reached Jerusalem, but they're on their way. We're going to find out that they were actually parked a little north of Jerusalem. They were up in southern Israel. Remember, Israel is the name of the northern kingdom. The biggest tribe within the northern kingdom is Ephraim. And so, in verse 2, and it was told to the house of David, that's the royal family, saying, Syria's forces are deployed in Ephraim. So they are deployed in Israel, not very far north of Jerusalem. So his heart, that is Ahaz's heart, and the heart of his people were moved as the trees of the woods are moved with wind. Well, that sets up a circumstance here where the king is going to go out and check the water supply. And God told Isaiah to go and meet the king. Now, when it talks about the king and his people were moved like trees in the wind, it's saying they were deathly afraid of what was going to happen. They were about to be attacked by two nations, one of which, Syria, was a rather powerful nation. But we're going to see a clue that's going to help us to understand something. At the moment, I'm not going to say exactly how it's going to help us, but there is an interesting feature that goes back through Israel's history. Remember when the people left Egypt, that as they were in the wilderness, there was the pillar of cloud during the day and the pillar of fire at night. The whole encampment surrounded the tabernacle of meeting, and above it was God made his presence known through the pillar of fire, and his Shekinah glory was resident there at the tabernacle. So Israel is gathered, all 12 tribes surround the tabernacle, and God makes his presence known. So remember the pillar of fire and of cloud. Now, as the Lord was speaking to Moses, Moses was very concerned about going out into the desert and being there without provision from God. And God assures him in Exodus 33:14, "My presence will go with you." What's going on here? God was with his people. God was with the nation. A few verses later in Exodus 33:16, "For how then will it be known that your people," this is Moses speaking to God, "and I have found grace in your sight, except you go with us?" What's going to make it so that we are distinct from other nations? What's going to prove that I didn't just have an idea one day, let's go out into the wilderness? How is it that people are going to know that we were led out here? Moses is saying, God's presence needs to be with them so that other nations would know that God is the one who has led them there, and therefore, God would be the one who would lead them into the promised land. "So we shall be separate, your people and I, from all the people who are upon the face of the earth." Israel alone could say, God is with us. The Shekinah glory was in their presence. Numbers 14, verse 9, is making it clear that although God had made promises to Israel, he promised to keep them, and he will keep them, those promises will be fulfilled in the millennium. But there could be consequences if the nation rebelled. And so the warning here is, only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. The Lord's presence is an important feature. Deuteronomy 31:17b. Now you might recall, this is right after the statement of the land covenant. The land covenant occupies Deuteronomy chapters 28 through 30. And here it's speaking about what will happen when Israel rebels. When Israel rebels against the land covenant, God says, "I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured. Their enemies will have victories. And many evils and troubles shall befall them, so that they will say in that day, have not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us?" That is, God is not with us. God has left us to reap what we have sown. Now, think also, 2 Samuel chapter 7. Why don't we turn there? 2 Samuel chapter 7. This passage is the giving of the Davidic covenant. And so David had wanted to build a temple to replace the tabernacle. He was told by Samuel, who was relaying what the Lord said, that no, that wasn't for him to do. David was a man of war. Now, a lot of people have interpreted that as, oh, well, you're a bad person because you're a man of war, and therefore I won't let you build the temple. No, instead, David was operating under the command of the Lord, and he provided the security that made it so that Solomon did not have to face lots of military conflict. David had provided security through all the wars that he led the nation in. As a result, Solomon was freed to be able to build the temple. It's not that David was bad as a man of war. It is that he had a responsibility that still needed to be carried out. And so it was up to Solomon, who would reap the benefits of the security provided by David, who would be able to build the temple. Okay, so God didn't allow David to build a house for him. But God built a house for David, that is a dynasty, which becomes known as the House of David. I want you to notice the statements of God being with David and with the future kings of the nation, that is of Judah. In 7:3, Nathan, as he speaks to David, "Go and do all that is in your heart, for the Lord is with you." Then in verse 9, God says, "And I have been with you wherever you, David, have gone, and have cut off all your enemies from before you, and have made you a great name, like the name of the great men who are on earth." And then verses 13 through 15. Speaks about the dynasty. "He shall build a house for my name," this is Solomon, "and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." Now this is looking forward, it's looking beyond Solomon. The dynasty is ultimately headed up by Jesus Christ. "And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I removed from before you." Notice here, it's speaking in terms of the Lord being with David, and with David's successor, especially being with the Messiah. So, as we are looking at the historical circumstance that was facing King Ahaz, what is happening is the elephant in the room is Assyria. That's up in the upper right. Assyria was very powerful. It covers much of the area of Iraq and eastern Syria today. And Assyria was getting ready to attack Syria and Israel. That's the reason that the king of Syria and the king of Israel want to form an alliance. They want to protect themselves against Assyria. They wanted for Judah to join them. But Ahaz looks at Syria and he looks at Israel and he says, "No, I'm not going to throw my lot in with you. I think you're going to lose." He ends up throwing his support with Assyria. As a result, Syria and Israel attack him because they don't want a two-front war to have to fight Judah at the same time that they're fighting Assyria. They figure Assyria isn't ready to attack. This is a good time to attack south, and that way they will not face a two-front war. I'd like to talk about the handout just a little bit. I have a public domain map that's on the left-hand side there. But I know that the size of the print and the lack of distinctiveness of colors makes it a little difficult to see the arrangement. So what I have on the right side of that is showing that Assyria is north and east. Assyria is, I'm trying to show the relative locations. Different maps will picture the territories differently, so I'm just giving a visual of the circumstance that they were facing. Okay, what we're going to see here is short and long-term prophecies. In other words, we're going to see God allowing Isaiah to look through the telescope and to see future events. And he's going to make some prophecies. But the prophecies, there are going to be short-term ones, and there are going to be longer-term ones. And so we need to set some of this up. And you'll notice that I ask a question near the bottom of the first page of the notes. How old were they? That is, how old was King Ahaz, and how old was Isaiah? Our tendency is to think of kings as being older and to think of prophets as being older. But that's not the way that it worked on this particular occasion. We are actually very early in Isaiah's ministry, and we are very early in the kingship of Ahaz. This chart, I have all of the pertinent information down on the bottom of the page. But you'll notice that I have set out the reigns of each of the kings. So Pekah, for Israel, was king from 752 to 732 BC, and then he died. So I have a skull right there. Then Rezin was king over Syria, and his time was 750 to 732. They both died at the same time in the same battle. The red border around those two is showing that they had an alliance. Remember, Israel and Syria are planning to attack Judah. Now, let's think about this for a moment. Israel should not have been fighting against Judah. Remember, Israel and Judah were, up until the time of Solomon, one nation. And then there was a rebellion, and we had it split into two parts. And lo and behold, we have brothers fighting against brothers. Tiglath-Pileser is the king of Assyria. And by the way, these top three men, each one of them was a usurper. None of them was the son of the prior king, whether you're looking at Israel, Syria, or Assyria. But now, what's in the large border, the sort of a tawny yellow color, all of these are down within Judah. Ahaz is in Judah, Isaiah, and Isaiah's two sons. But you'll notice, if you look at Tiglath-Pileser and Ahaz, you'll see that there's a border again, because Ahaz is going to join into an alliance with Assyria. And so the years of Tiglath-Pileser as being king were from 745 to 727 BC. Ahaz a little more complicated, because he had two co-regencies that ran from 750 to 735, and then he was the sole king from 735 to 715. Interestingly, the point when Isaiah confronts Ahaz in 735 4 BC, Ahaz is 21 years old. He's a young man. He has just taken over the kingship from his father Jotham. Presumably, part of the reason for Pekah and Rezin wanting to attack now is they perceive that a 21-year-old king whose father has just died, who was the more important regent, that maybe there's an opportunity. But now, look at Isaiah. We're not told how old Isaiah was, but Isaiah started his ministry as a prophet in the year 740 BC, and we see him active as a prophet clear until 680 BC. That's 60 years of ministry. I would assume he's at least 20 years old here. So we have two young men, Ahaz and Isaiah, are both young men. Something else that's consistent with Isaiah being a young man is he's going to have two children that are born within this time period. His older son is going to be mentioned in our very passage here in Isaiah chapter 7. And there is going to be something that will happen before he turns 20. Then in Isaiah chapter 8, we're going to have the birth of Isaiah's second son, Maher Shalal Hashbaz. And he was born around 732 BC, and there's a prophecy connected with his birth. Well, this all is giving background, but I know it's a lot of details here to keep track of. So let's look at this a little bit differently. In Isaiah chapter 7, we are going to be introduced to Sher Yashub. He would have been a toddler in Isaiah chapter 7, but Maher was not yet born. Now, let's look at first at the short-term prophecy that's given in Isaiah chapter 8. Let me turn there. Isaiah chapter 8. The prophecy is that Isaiah, your wife will become pregnant with a son. She's not pregnant at the point of the revelation being given. Before your son can say, my father or my mother, so somewhere in the vicinity of 1 year old, Rezin and Pekah will be no more. So this prophecy has four ingredients. Says, your wife's going to become pregnant, she's going to have a baby boy, and there's going to be the invasion by Assyria that will result in the death of both Rezin and Pekah. And all of this will happen before your son is capable of saying, my father or my mother. And that would be to say, my father would be Avi. I mean, just a very, very simple thing to be said. So the prophetess, Isaiah's wife, soon became pregnant. Less than a year later, 732 BC, Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria conquered Syria and Israel. Let's start at Isaiah 8:1. Moreover, the Lord said to me, take a large scroll and write on it with a man's pen concerning Maher Shalal Hashbaz, and I will make for myself faithful witnesses to record Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Yeberechiah. Then I went to the prophetess, I take it that it is not saying here that she was one who prophesied, but I take it that this is the term for the wife of the prophet. So here it's, I went to her, is speaking in terms of intimacy. And she conceived and bore a son. So notice she was not pregnant at the time that 8:1 was stated, where Isaiah was told about Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Then the Lord said to me, call his name Maher Shalal Hashbaz. For before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria, Damascus being the capital of Syria and Samaria being the capital of Israel, will be taken away before the king of Israel. So what is being prophesied at this point is a short-term prophecy. Within 2 years, so giving time for Isaiah's wife, who were never told her name, to become pregnant, to have a son, and that son to become old enough to be able to say, my father or my mother, that within that time span of 2 years, it is bye-bye Syria and Israel. They will be conquered by Assyria. And lo and behold, Rezin and Pekah will be dead. So we have that short-term prophecy. But we're going to have more prophecies. Now, we've looked first at Maher Shalal Hashbaz, but then we have Shir Yashuv. These are two separate boys. And in chapter 8, we're looking at a son who is not yet born. But in chapter 7, we're going to have Isaiah taking a son to the waterworks. So what we're going to have here in Isaiah 7 is four prophecies. There's a very short-term prophecy saying that Rezin and Pekah will not defeat Jerusalem. There is a fairly short term prophecy. Assyria will invade Israel, the northern kingdom, before Shir Yashuv is 20 years old. There's a longer short term prophecy. Israel, the northern kingdom, will cease to be a nation in less than 65 years. And there's a very long-term prophecy, the virgin birth of Messiah, of Emmanuel, God with us. Okay, let's look here at the map. We have Assyria, Syria, Israel, and Judah. So the question here is, how are the alliances going to be formed? Pretty serious indications that Assyria was wanting to return to these western areas. Tiglath-Pileser had previously had western campaigns. Syria and Israel had become very worried that, lo and behold, Assyria is going to come in and they're going to conquer them and things will become unbearable for them. So Syria and Israel form an alliance. Apparently, they approached Judah and said, why don't you join with us? They thought, two of us against Assyria, maybe we've got a chance, but it will especially be good if we have a third country, if Judah joins in with us. Ahaz seems to have said, no, I don't think so. He apparently had assessed that Assyria was very strong, and he thought, you know, if I don't join them, but let Assyria know that I haven't joined them, then maybe things will go well for me. Maybe when Assyria conquers Syria and Israel, they'll leave me alone. So we're looking at perspective. How is it that Ahaz looks at the situation as opposed to how he should look at it? It's a matter of perspective. When one looks at a glass, one can say it's half empty or it's half full. There are different ways of looking at the circumstances. Ahaz's perspective, he says, well, if I obey God and don't form an alliance with anybody else, then Syria will be mad at me, Israel will be mad at me, they're on my doorstep, they're ready to attack me, and because they will have taken over my country, then when Assyria comes, he's going to hit them by hitting me as well. So he says, I don't know that I want to follow God, because if I do that, I might have three armies come in and invade me. Okay, another possibility, second one, which would be the black arrow that's to the left. Let's see, I realize I'm going to have to redo this a little bit. Okay, he says, well, if I join Syria and Israel in an alliance against Assyria, well, then Assyria is going to come and they're going to do me in after they do in Syria and Israel. But on the other hand, if I join Assyria, I might have to weather things for a little bit, but I'll call my good buddy Tiglath-Pileser and say, hey, you've got to hit Syria and take the pressure off me by making them come and defend against their northern border. So Ahaz is looking at this and he says, doesn't look good if I obey God, and it doesn't look good if I join with Israel and Syria. Looks like my best choice is to join with Assyria. So it's like the orange here being squeezed. Syria and Israel say, uh-oh, if we don't deal with Judah now, after a while we're going to face a two-front war. So they decided it's time to attack Judah. And so God's perspective is, instead, don't join up with them. It's an interesting thing that the Lord says about the two kings, Rezin of Syria and Pekah of Israel. Let's go back to Isaiah chapter 7. In Isaiah 7, verse 4, Isaiah is told to say to Ahaz, take heed and be quiet. Just chill. It's time to relax. Do not fear or be faint-hearted, for these two stubs of smoking firebrands, for the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria, and the son of Remaliah, because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Ephraim is another name for Israel, because Ephraim is the biggest tribe in the northern kingdom. And the son of Remaliah have plotted evil against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and trouble it. Let us make a gap in his wall for ourselves and set a king over them, the son of Tabaal. God has just said, these guys are like pieces of wood in a fire. They look threatening right now, but it won't be long and they'll be gone. Isaiah chapter 8, he's going to say at that time, less than 2 years, they'll be gone. Here, it's less than 4 years, they're going to be gone. Isaiah's saying, don't worry about all this. God has this under control. So let's now look at the prophecies in Isaiah chapter 7. First, let's look at the very short-term prophecy. Now we noticed when we looked at Isaiah chapter 7 verse 2, and it was told to the house of David, the royal family, saying, Syria's forces are deployed in Ephraim. So Syria from Damascus has sent troops down into Israel, the northern kingdom, ready to attack Jerusalem. Ditto that we have troops from Israel. So we've got an alliance, and the alliance is poised to attack Judah, in particular to attack Jerusalem. And the Lord says, nothing is going to come of that. We find the short-term prophecy in Isaiah 7, verse 7. Now let's start at verse 6. What it is that those two kings have said is, let us go up against Judah and trouble it. Let us make a gap in its wall for ourselves and set a king over them, the son of Tobiah. What their plan was, let's go and besiege Jerusalem. We'll batter a hole through the wall. We'll conquer Jerusalem and we'll put our own man in charge. And that man is not going to launch a war against us. And that way, when we're trying to protect ourselves against Assyria, we don't have to worry about another front being opened on our south. So, what does the Lord say? Verse 7. Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus. The head of Damascus is resin. They're just humans. Ahaz, think. God will protect you if you don't go in unbelief. But what's being said is, they're not going to attack Jerusalem. Probably what has happened is they started becoming more worried about what was going to happen from Assyria and pulled their troops north and put them in order to protect themselves against Assyria, and they did not go through with this attack on Jerusalem. Now, we do find in another passage that they had made an attack that seems to be at a different point in time than this particular passage, and I'm not going to get into all of the technicalities of the chronology on that. But we have this very short-term prophecy saying, you don't have to worry about them besieging Jerusalem. That's not going to happen. They're quickly going to turn around and protect their rear, and they're not going to be bothering you. You don't have to take steps now. That's not what you need to do. You don't need to form an alliance with Assyria. This will take care of itself very quickly. But then there is a fairly short-term prophecy. This one's going to take a matter of years, a little less than 20. And it is going to be before Isaiah's son, Shir Yashuv, reaches age 20. Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria will invade Israel. This prophecy begins at verse 15. Many people have seen it as a continuation of the Emmanuel prophecy, but it simply doesn't work that way. There are some details that would say this ought to be treated as a separate prophecy. Now, in my New King James, the word child is capitalized, but it should be lowercase in verse 16. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the child would be Shir Yashuv. So let's, before we get into this prophecy, let's look at what we're introduced about Shir Yashuv. And for that, we turn to Isaiah 7:3. Remember, of Ahaz and the nation of Judah is shaking like trees in the wind because they have Syrian troops and troops from Israel poised not far from their border, not far from Jerusalem in Ephraim. We saw that in verses 1 and 2. Now in verse 3. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out now to meet Ahaz, you and Shear Yashuv, your son. By the way, I haven't given you the names of the meanings of the names of the two sons. Shear Yashuv is a remnant will return. This is looking at, God is still operating under the terms of the unconditional covenants. And it's not that Judah is going to get wiped out. When it does, under discipline, ultimately face the Babylonian captivity, there is a remnant that will return. God is faithful to his covenant. And with regard to Maher Shalal Hashbaz, as quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil, that would be things that an army would say as they're psyching themselves up for attack. But before Shear Yashuv reaches age 20, Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria will invade Israel. Okay, so in verse 3, Isaiah takes his son to the end of the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field and say to him, so say to King Ahaz. So he has something that he's supposed to relay, but he brings his son and he would say to the king, this is my son, Shear Yashuv. And king's thinking, that kind of sounds like bad news. Kind of sounds like there's going to be defeat and then ultimately there's going to be a remnant that returns. I don't think that he liked the name Shear Yashuv. But this is the child that's being referred to in verses 15 and 16. Curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that you dread will be forsaken by both of her kings. And the land being forsaken is looking at the ultimate destruction of the nation. And that happened in 722 BC. That's less than 20 years after this prophecy. This view, and the reason for taking it is age 20. Remember in the wilderness, who was held responsible for the decision not to go into the land there at as the spies went in and 10 gave a bad report there at Kadesh Barnea, and only two, Caleb and Joshua, said, "We can take it. The Lord has promised." The ones that were not allowed to enter into the land were that older generation, the ones age 20 and above. The only ones out of that older generation that were able to enter the land was Caleb and Joshua. I take it, and others take it, that the language here is speaking that that age where one is held responsible for having chosen the good and refusing the evil, age 20, age of maturity. So lo and behold, 722, the kings of the northern kingdom forsake the land because they are defeated, never to rise again as a nation. So do not fear these stubs of smoking firebrands. They're mere humans. They're going to die shortly, and the kings over that land are ultimately going to forsake it because they will lose against Assyria. Now, let's see, I got a little ahead of myself there. They would there face defeat by Assyria, but it's not the ultimate defeat. The ultimate defeat is predicted less than 65 years until 722. I got a little bit out of chronology. So less than 65 years remain until Israel ceases to be a national entity. So now that prepares us for the long-term prophecy of Isaiah 7. This is the one that's the most controversial. This is the Emmanuel prophecy. And the question here becomes, how does this one get reconciled? What makes it important to handle this one properly is that Matthew chapter 1 cites it. So all this was done, speaking about the preparation of getting Joseph and Mary to Bethlehem and of Jesus being born there, to a virgin. So all this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, "The virgin shall be with child and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel." That translation is given, "God with us." Now we have Matthew 1:23 citing Isaiah 7:14. In red, I have marked words that are the same between the passages. "Behold, the virgin shall be with child, bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel," which is translated, "God with us," the Isaiah passage. "Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel." Now you might say, well, in Isaiah, it says that the virgin will call his name Emmanuel. And in Matthew, it says they, that his people, will call him. Well, both are true. Mary called him that. Other people would have called him that as well. No difficulty reconciling that feature. Let's look at how this... I forgot. I'm on a computer that doesn't have my Hebrew font. Sorry, this doesn't look at all like it's supposed to. Where you see... actually, the transliteration font is what didn't come through. So, Emmanuel... literally, both it is im is with, and then anachnu or anu shortened down, us, and then el is God. So with us, God. Now we have a conundrum. This has plagued interpreters. How could a virgin birth 730 years later be assigned to Ahaz? Okay, let's read the passage and let's see the conundrum. This is what has caused much consternation among interpreters. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, verse 3, go out now to meet Ahaz, you and Shear-Yashub, your son, at the end of the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to the puller's field, and say to him, take heed and be quiet. Do not fear or be faint-hearted for these two stubs of smoking firebrands, for the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria and the son of Remaliah, because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliah have plotted evil against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and trouble it, and let us make a gap in its wall for ourselves and set a king over them, the son of Tabaal, thus says the Lord God. It shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be broken, so it will not be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria. Head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. If you will not believe, surely you will not be established. Moreover, the Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. Then he said, hear now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men? But will you weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Now, at first glance, the big question comes. Ahaz will be long since dead before Jesus is virgin born. So, how is this a sign for Ahaz? This conundrum is what has caused all of the difficulties on this passage. There's a simple way out of the conundrum, but you can see the problem. What I will say is that the issue of how would this be a sign to Ahaz ultimately is like dragging a red herring across the trail where the fox went, causing the hunting dog to go and chase after the red herring and let the fox off scot-free. It is a distraction. What we're going to see is that the passage itself is going to give evidence that it is never intended that the birth of Emmanuel would be a sign to Ahaz. The English makes it look like that. There's a very simple feature that's going on here. that indicates it was never intended as a sign for Ahaz. Let's go through this. But what we're going to do is we're going to look first at the view that most of scholarship and the Revised Standard Version take on this, that they treat it as the fulfillment is a birth in the 8th century. In other words, there's going to be a birth very shortly in Ahaz's time. That's view number one. View number two, there's a 1st century BC birth, and that's Jesus' birth. 1st century BC because of his birth is actually dated to 4 BC. And then there are those that say, well, it's both. Both an 8th century and a 1st century BC one. So let's look at these one by one. View one is an 8th century fulfillment for Ahaz. Now, it has an advantage. The first advantage is that, well, it's clear that Ahaz would have lived to see it. And that may seem, from reading the English, like that's important. It may seem, from the English, that Isaiah promised a sign for Ahaz. Then what these people will argue is that the word Alma, which is here translated virgin, doesn't really mean virgin. It just means a young woman who's not necessarily a virgin. Now, there are disadvantages to that view. A birth to a young woman would not be a sign at all. It's not unusual for a young woman to have a son. It happens all the time. Now, then, next disadvantage, if this is Isaiah's meaning, then Matthew has misused it. Matthew has taken the translation virgin when it really should have been a young woman, and it wasn't talking about Jesus at all. It's talking about some woman there in the 8th century BC. So if view one is right, Matthew's misused it. Now, clearly I reject this view, but it creates a real issue here. There's another big disadvantage. It misses an important Hebrew grammar issue. And that is the form of the word you. We'll talk about that. So, the advantages. I'm going to say that these are lightweight advantages. They're like a feather. They really don't carry much weight. They're not big deals. It's not going to matter that Ahaz would have lived to see its fulfillment because the sign isn't given to Ahaz. The English may seem to suggest that Isaiah promised a sign for Ahaz, but that's not an accurate understanding. And the word Alma actually does mean virgin. It doesn't merely mean young woman. But the disadvantages are quite weighty. A birth to a young woman would not be a sign at all. That is, it's not unusual. If this is Isaiah's meaning, then Matthew would have misused Isaiah 7:14. I do not believe that he did so. And it misses an important Hebrew grammar issue. Let's look at the passage and let's see why these disadvantages are important. Look at verse 10. Moreover, the Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. Ask for a really hard sign. Ahaz, God is prepared to give you a big proof that what he's saying is true. He's asking you to tell him a really difficult sign. Is it a really difficult thing that a young woman through natural means would bear a son? It happens all the time. So, first pregnancies are not rare. But this is not what we would call an Everest, Marianas Trench kind of sign. Let me see how to illustrate this. The highest point above sea level on planet Earth is Mount Everest. And the lowest point under sea level is in the Mariana Trench. If we were to put Mount Everest on top of the sea here, and then we picture the Mariana Trench, the depth of the Mariana Trench is so deep that the Mount Everest would have water on top of it. But you put them on top of each other, we have 12.4 miles distance. The point here, Ahaz is being told, ask for a difficult sign. Ask for something really difficult, and the Lord is willing to do that. The disadvantages are very weighty. So now let's look at an 8th century fulfillment. Now, I haven't yet gotten into that Hebrew grammar issue. We'll talk about that a little later. But an 8th century fulfillment here, in conclusion, just has too many big problems. It's very, very difficult. It just doesn't meet the requirements of the passage. But now let's look at a first century BC fulfillment, a prediction of the virgin birth of Jesus. Now this has really weighty advantages. If you notice those D11s and you see the men standing there, they can move some real dirt. We're talking about heavy weight advantages. A virgin birth would be a huge sign. That doesn't happen every day. In fact, it's only happened once. And the word Alma does indeed mean virgin. And the other words, Betula or Naara, are words that can refer to virgins, but do not necessarily only refer to virgins. The Greek Old Testament translated Alma here as Parthenos, which is the Greek word for virgin. And if this is Isaiah's meaning, if he is talking about a future actual birth by one who is virgin, a virgin, so it's a virgin conception and birth, then Matthew has used Isaiah 7:14 correctly. Furthermore, it perceives a key Hebrew grammar issue properly, you versus y'all. I'll talk about that. All seven times that the word Alma shows up in the Old Testament, it refers to virgin. Every single time. Now, Betula in Joel 1:8 talks to a widow. Clearly not to a virgin. And Naara has 9 exceptions. Once it refers to a prostitute. 6 times it refers to a concubine. And Ruth, with the first part of the book, became a widow when her husband died. Now she's a widow and she is called a Naara, a maiden. But it doesn't necessarily mean virgin. The word that is used here is Alma. We have no places where it is used for anything except virgin. So, that's a huge sign. The word Alma means virgin. the Greek Old Testament, which was translated about 250 BC, long before Jesus was born, by Jewish people. They rendered it as virgin. They understood it properly. Isaiah has used it correctly, and the issue of you versus y'all is going to be handled correctly. Now, as we look at regional English, if you want to make a you plural in Yankee country, you might say you guys, or some places say yous guys. But in the South, it's y'all. And y'all is not an abbreviation for you all. It is actually an abbreviation for ye all. It's been tracked to the Scots who were sent from Scotland to Ireland that became known as the Scots Irish, and some of them made their way to the colonies, but by the time they got here, the prime land along the seacoast was taken. They ended up going into the Appalachians. That group of Scots-Irish came from a part of Scotland that said ye all. Ye is plural. And then as it came to the Appalachians, it was shortened from ye all to y'all. It is plural, and properly used, y'all is plural. Very important, Hebrew, Greek, and Aramaic all have distinct different forms for you singular versus y'all. And that's going to be very important in this passage. I will go through the passage, and I would urge you to mark the places where it's singular and the places where it's plural. It is unfortunate that English translations, by and large, other than the Old King James, and a few other versions, make no distinction between you singular and you plural. Now, we have seen already that the passage talks about the house of David. Notice House of David came up in verse 2, and it comes up again within the passage, very, very importantly in verse 13. Then he said, "Hear now, O House of David." Now let's illustrate that. In England, we have the royal family. This is a picture when the queen was still living, but if you use the word you, that would address one of them. But if you say y'all, you're talking to all of them. So it's important here to note that House of Israel, or House of David, is a plural concept. It's talking about the royal family. Interestingly, both Joseph and Mary in the Gospels are said to be of the house of David. They were part of the royal family. The royal family wasn't just in David's day. It wasn't even just in Ahaz's day. But they knew who it was that was qualified to be king. Who was part of the royal family. All of that was tracked, and Jesus was born of royalty, and that it's very interesting how Matthew and Luke give us the details that show that Jesus is a qualified king. But we'll get into all of that now, but it is important to know this feature. I would mark a P above all these y'alls that are here in red, as opposed to you and your and yourself, which are singulars. When it's in the blue and it's of you form, it's singular. So I put an S and a P at various points here within this passage. So as we start out, Isaiah is told to speak to Ahaz. So he brings his son and he's told to speak to Ahaz. And the point where you and y'all start coming up is in verse 9b. But the house of Israel, the house of David is in view. That's apparent from verse 13. And so in verse 9b, if y'all, that is the house of David, if the royal family will not believe, surely y'all's family will not be established. What's being hinted at here is the theoretical possibility that there could have been a continuing line of kings with Messiah being born to a reigning king instead of being born to the family of Joseph and Mary, obviously with a virgin birth, having a legal adoption, bringing him as a legal son of Joseph. But theoretically, Joseph could have been reigning king, and Jesus could have been born into the family of a reigning king. That would have been the converse of this. If they had believed and therefore did not rebel against what Isaiah is saying, if they had not formed the alliance with Syria, they could have been established, and instead of having the kingship taken away and Jesus being born to someone who was qualified to be king but who wasn't reigning. Very interesting. If y'all, plural, house of David will not believe, surely y'all, house of David, shall not be established. But then in verse 10, moreover, the Lord spoke again to Ahaz. So now, instead of aiming the comments at royal family that's present, it wasn't just Ahaz that went out there, but there were other members of the family who were there. And Isaiah is using plurals to make it clear he's not just talking to Ahaz in verse 9, but now in verse 10, he's just talking to Ahaz. Specifically, the Lord spoke again to Ahaz through Isaiah, saying, ask, you ask, a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. False piety. He was given a command. He was expected to say, okay, Lord, do this. Lord would have followed through. Ahaz would then have even more reason to believe what the prophet had said to him, because it's validated by a sign from the Lord himself. But Ahaz doesn't want to know what the Lord wants, because he doesn't want to go that direction. Then Isaiah said, y'all hear now, O house of David. Is it a small thing for y'all to weary men, but will y'all weary my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give y'all a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Interestingly, later on in the passage, Isaiah returns to addressing Ahaz. Notice that later on it becomes a you singular. Verses 15 and 16, it's all you singulars. The sign of the virgin birth is meant for the house of David. And the house of David is something that continued and continued and continued. so that Joseph and Mary both are said to be members of the house of David. The nation was supposed to realize, and particularly the house of David, that when there was a virgin birth, this was Emmanuel. Think back. Earlier we saw how with the pillar of fire and of cloud, God was with the nation. And then we saw that God would pull away when the nation went into rebellion. Later on, time of Ezekiel, Ezekiel chapter 10, the Shekinah pulls away from the temple. The temple was left Ichabod. God was not with his people. We have here a prophecy of Emmanuel, which is a nation that was in a status of Ichabod. Where is the glory? There is no glory. It is departed. But the glory returns because Emmanuel, the virgin-born Messiah, has come. Okay, this has serious advantages. Virgin birth would be an absolutely huge sign. Remember, as tall as Everest, as deep as Mariana's Trench, high above, in the depths. Alma means virgin. We don't have any exceptions, but the other words that can refer to virgin are, there are very clear exceptions on those other words. The Greek Old Testament translated it as Parthenos, and that was translated 250 BC, long before Jesus was born. And this would have Matthew using Isaiah 7:14 correctly. And the key grammatical issue, you singular versus y'all plural, is a recognition that the sign was not meant to be seen by Ahaz. It was a sign to be understood by the generation in which Emmanuel would be born. Well, as we look at the disadvantages, they're pretty lightweight. Ahaz would not have lived 700 years to see the sign, but the passage isn't saying that it was a sign that he would see. It was a sign for the house of David, which is something that continues after the deaths of those that heard Isaiah's words directly. Yes, the English seems to imply that Ahaz would see the sign, but that's not taking into account the difference between you and y'all. So this is weighty in favor of a first century fulfillment. This passage, we have Isaiah looking in his telescope way ahead to the coming of the virgin-born Emmanuel, the virgin-born Messiah. Matthew has used this passage correctly. Now there is a third view. The third view says, well, what about a both and? Okay, well, it has an advantage. Both Ahaz would see something and the house of David also. But wait a moment, disadvantages. The 8th century birth that Ahaz would see would not be miraculous, nor would it be a sign. And if Isaiah were aiming at a near-term birth in the 8th century, why would we expect a 1st century one? View 2, 1st century birth of Jesus as the only fulfillment, has the weighty advantages with insignificant disadvantages. Therefore, I reject views 1 and 2, 3. The passage is pointing to the birth of the Messiah only, not for something for Ahaz to see. Dual fulfillment idea of first and 8th centuries just is not a serious treatment. It has to butcher the meaning of Alma, and which every single use that we have in the text refers to a virgin, whereas the other words that can refer to virgins do not necessarily refer to virgins. View two is the best one. So as we look at this, the short and long-term prophecies of Isaiah 7 and 8, we have very short-term. Rezin and Pekah will not defeat Jerusalem. Then, less than 1 year after Isaiah's second son's birth, Rezin and Pekah die. Then we have another prophecy in Isaiah 7 that Assyria will invade Israel before Shear Yashub is 20. And a longer term one, Israel will cease as a nation with the people being deported so that really threw things topsy-turvy, making it difficult for humans to possibly reconstitute the nation. God can do that. He will. That happened less than 65 years later, and then, long-term, the virgin birth of Emmanuel, Jesus, the Messiah. Okay. So, virgin birth would be a huge sign. That was what Ahaz was told to look for that. When Ahaz says, I don't want to do that, Isaiah turned his back on him and no longer spoke to him, but spoke and addressed with plurals, the house of David, the royal family, and said, Ahaz is all out to lunch, but house of David, there's something for you to look forward to. House of David, when there is a virgin birth, that is a return to the time of God with us. God was with the people in the wilderness. God was with kings of Judah, as promised in the Davidic covenant. It wasn't going to be like with Saul, where the Holy Spirit would be taken away. But the nation came under discipline, and God, shall we say, stepped away. Ezekiel 10, the glory of the Lord departs. And then, with the birth of Jesus, the glory and presence of God in the flesh returned to Israel as Jesus was born. The prophet's telescope. He looked out there because of revelation and saw things that ordinary humans could not see. He was able to make short-term prophecies, and he was able to make long-term prophecies because God had revealed them to him. Each one of those was a basis for the nation of Judah, under the leadership of Ahaz, to obey God, not to align itself with Assyria. That proved disastrous, although Ahaz himself stayed in a subservient role and didn't ruffle the feathers of Assyria. But later generations of Judah paid the piper. They faced great difficulties because of decisions that he made that day.